Well, the case is submitted. We'll hear argument next to number 86-1992, the Immigration and Naturalization Service versus Panja Panjilinan. Mr. Klonoff, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the issue in this case is whether the Ninth Circuit was correct in ordering citizenship for the 16 respondents, all Philippine veterans of World War II, under a statute that expired in 1946. We submit that this Court has already answered that question in 1973 in INS versus Hibby. The Court in Hibby held that the Attorney General's action in withdrawing the Vice Consul from the Philippines and the government's failure to publicize the program did not give rise to an equitable basis for disregarding the December 31, 1946 cutoff. And as I will explain during this argument, respondents' argument is nothing more than a change of label. The substantive argument made in this case is identical to that rejected in Hibby. We further submit that Hibby was correctly decided and that there is no basis for this Court to overrule it. To begin with, the relief ordered by the Ninth Circuit in this case is foreclosed by four naturalization statutes in addition to the 1946 cutoff in Hibby. And as I will explain, those statutes prohibit a court from ordering citizenship under the expired and repealed 1940 Act, even as to those situations in which there was a timely application under the 1940 Act that was still pending and had not been ruled upon. And we submit that these naturalization statutes are dispositive for two reasons. First, as this Court made clear in Fedorenko, and indeed as early as the Ginsburg case, a court has no equitable authority to disregard statutory requirements for citizenship. And more generally, the Court of Appeals' invocation of its equitable authority in violation of statutory mandate is, in fact, an abuse of equitable authority. We submit it as well established that a court of equity may not order relief that is contrary to the legislative intent. In addition, it is our position that the underlying premise of the Court of Appeals opinion is false. In our view, the Attorney General's actions were entirely lawful and were within his discretion under the 1940 Act. And as I will explain, that is true for three reasons. First, Section 705 of the Act left it to the Attorney General to decide where to place examiners, when to place them, and for how long. In addition, the decision in this case, the revocation of the Vice Consul's authority, was based on bona fide foreign policy concerns. And as this Court has made clear in numerous cases cited in the government's briefs, a high degree of judicial deference must be given in the context of executive foreign policy decisions. And that applies a fortiori when a court is reviewing those decisions four decades later. In addition, there's added discretion in this case because there is no evidence whatsoever that Congress disagreed with what the Attorney General did. In fact, as we have explained, all of the statutory enactments since the 1940 Act only confirm that the Attorney General acted lawfully in what he did.
And you say that despite the language of the statute?
Language of the 40 Act, you mean? Absolutely. As we have explained in our brief, it is anything but clear whether that statute was intended to apply to individuals who were enlisted or inducted in the Philippines. And the Attorney General had to answer a number of difficult issues before he even determined that it applied there, particularly in the context of the Philippine Commonwealth Army. It's anything but clear that Congress intended to authorize the naturalization of some quarter of a million individuals who were serving in their own army.
Well, we naturalized a lot of them, though, over there, didn't we?
We did. That's true. And, in fact, that serves to undermine respondents' argument that there was something invidious about what was being done. That only confirms that the decision was made for legitimate foreign policy reasons. But going beyond that, Justice Blackmun, the statute, as described by the eight dissenting justices below, is completely open-ended. There is no mandate that the Attorney General place an examiner in any particular location or for any particular period of time. It is left up to his discretion. And as we have pointed out in our brief, the three-month period in which an examiner was actually placed in the Philippines before his authority was revoked compares quite favorably and is perhaps comparable to the post-to-post or rotation system that was employed elsewhere in the world. So ultimately, it may be, in fact, that these respondents and others similarly situated had as much access to an examiner as soldiers elsewhere in the world. So we don't think that there is anything in the statute that compelled the Attorney General to leave an examiner there. And indeed, we submit it was entirely within his discretion to do what he did. And again, I would point out that the subsequent congressional statutes only confirm that. We have in 1946, while the statute was still in effect, we have Congress passing a statute indicating that membership in the Philippine Commonwealth Army does not constitute membership in the United States Armed Forces. That directly contradicts the Ninth Circuit's assumption that the plain reading of the statute compelled the Attorney General to apply the program in the Philippines. We have the 1948 statute, which made clear that that enlisting or being inducted in the Philippines does not entitle to the individual to citizenship unless that person is later a lawful permanent resident of the United States. Same provision in 1952. There is simply no evidence whatsoever that this program was intended to apply in the Philippines. And we challenged respondents to cite anything in the legislative history, either to show that the program was initially intended to apply in the Philippines or some recognition on the part of Congress that the Attorney General had erred or engaged in misconduct, and they have not cited any. So we would submit, in light of that complete absence of anything by Congress to contradict what the Attorney General did, and given the foreign policy concerns that were the basis for the decision, it would be particularly inappropriate to second-guess that decision 40 years later.
Maybe I don't really understand your argument. You say that they didn't intend it to apply in the Philippines at all?
We're saying that at the time the statute was enacted.
Which was when?
1942.
And what was going on in the international world at that time?
Well, we would concede that there were battles.
Main fighting by the American forces at Bataan at that time?
There were significant fighting there. But
significant? I mean, wasn't that the part of the war we're most interested in at that time?
That is correct, but it's simply there's no reflection in the legislative history that we have found or that respondents have found that Congress was acting to reward those individuals, the 250,000 people.
Who were they rewarding?
They were rewarding, there were some 80,000 people who were naturalized around the world in Iceland, England,
you think soldiers, the members Congress of the Congress was thinking about in early 1942?
We think so. We think the fact that in 1946, Congress specifically said that membership in the Commonwealth Army does not constitute membership in the armed forces for purposes of government benefits would support it. All we're saying, we don't know what Congress intended. Congress wasn't clear. They were clear in the World War I statute. They specifically mentioned the Philippines. They weren't clear in the World War II statute. All we're saying is you have a statute that on its face has a 1946 cutoff. And as this court said in Hibby, the public policy underlying that cutoff is clear and must be recognized. And that has to be balanced against what at most is an uncertain congressional intent as to whether the statute was meant to apply to the Philippines at all.
What if we disagree and think it was intended to apply to the Philippines?
Then we still think, for several reasons, that that's not dispositive. In fact, let me take it at several different levels. The Second Circuit in Oligario, the reasoning of which we agree with on the statute, assumed for purposes of the decision that the statute was intended to apply to the Philippines. But what the court said was that's only the beginning of the question, because the president, in revoking his authority, had discretion to do so under Section 705 of the statute, and more particularly as a result of the foreign affairs concerns that were the basis for the revocation. So it would be our submission that even if Congress had been clear that the statute was intended to apply to the Philippines, that in light of the foreign policy issue that faced the executive and in light of the very reasonable and tailored response of the Attorney General, that that was within his authority under the 1940 Act. Furthermore, even if the conduct is considered to be erroneous, if the Attorney General had acted under a misperception, we think that Hibby still forecloses the claim, because it is not enough to simply err. As the court indicated, there was no affirmative misconduct there, and accordingly, no basis for ordering equitable relief 4 decades later. So we think that Hibby would be dispositive, regardless of whether or not this court agrees with us on the interpretation of the statute. We bring that out about whether the program was intended to apply in the Philippines only to reinforce our position that this court has to weigh, on the one hand, a clear congressional intent expressed over the years from the 1940 statute itself through 1961 in repeated statutes of the public policy that the 40 Act expires, it's revoked, and that all petitions have to be considered under current law. And the court has to balance that against a rather vague, at best, intention on the part of Congress. And as we indicated, if Congress was so concerned about the individuals in the Commonwealth Army obtaining citizenship, it would have been astonishing for Congress to have come along in 1948 and explicitly made clear that enlistment or induction in the Philippines does not qualify someone for citizenship unless he later becomes a lawful permanent resident.
Well, that's a different Congress, of course. You're talking as though Congress is one Congress out there. I mean, what?
That is true, but it is very close in time, Justice Scalia. In fact, the cutoff date, 1946 cutoff date, was established in 1945. As an amendment, and then we're talking about a Congress 3 years later. We're actually talking about a Congress 1 year later, because the Rescission Act, which said that the statute does, that the Commonwealth Army is not to be treated as the United States Army, that was 1946, 1 year later. And I would note furthermore, as explained in the court in Oligario, the Congress in 1945 that passed the cutoff amendment, during the course of its deliberations, Senator Hayden made the remark that it was his understanding of current law that Philippine veterans or soldiers were not eligible for citizenship unless they later came to the United States. And as the Oligario Court points out, no one in Congress expressed any disagreement with that observation. Now, again, our analysis or our submission in no way depends on that, as I've explained to Justice O'Connor. We just think it's important to point out that the Ninth Circuit, which based its opinion on what it called, quote, the expressed intent of Congress, is not expressed at all. It is at most implied and really requires a good degree of reading.
Maybe you've touched it, but why was the 46th law passed?
The 46th law?
Yeah.
In part, it was passed, Justice Marshall, because of a concern by Congress about various kinds of monetary benefits.
They didn't want the Filipinos to get.
They didn't want the.
So it was aimed at getting rid of them.
No, I don't think so. I think what the concern was is that the Congress hadn't really focused on the fact that.
Yeah, just in case they might get it, they're going to make sure they don't get it. Well, that's what Congress did.
But what Congress was focusing on, Justice Marshall, was the fact that their enactments were premised on membership in the United States Armed Forces. The Commonwealth was brought into the service of the United States Army only by executive order. And it really hadn't been focused by Congress on the fact that you were bringing in 250,000 people who were therefore going to be eligible to all these benefits. But let me say, Justice Marshall, one thing that's extremely interesting is that in the course of passing the 1946 legislation, actually it was a statement afterwards, and we've quoted it at length in our brief, Senator Hayden, who was one of the co-sponsors of that bill, pointed out that one of the intents behind it was to make clear that members of the Commonwealth Army were not entitled to citizenship, that those people were fighting primarily to serve the independence of their own country, and that, in fact, it would be no service to these individuals to bring them here where they were here.
Let's not discuss Senator Hayden, please.
Let's not discuss
him here. I mean, I know some of his reasons for this.
I'm not sure what Your Honor is referring to, but I was
you
responding.
You were answering my question.
Yeah, I was responding as to what was behind.
I tell you that won't help me.
Let me
ask you this about Mr. Clay. Isn't it correct that the 46 Act was to make sure that the Filipinos were not eligible under the GI Bill of Rights? That's basically what it was.
That was in large part, but
I mean,
what I'm
saying
is, it would
have been very, very expensive to add this additional group of veterans to that entitlement.
Well, the statute was worded in a very open-ended fashion. It said that
wasn't that the central purpose of it?
That was, and all I'm pointing out is that a later remark about one of the purposes of the statute being to make clear that for purposes of the citizenship program, members of the Commonwealth Army were not to be treated as in the armed forces. If I could turn back just briefly to the Hibby point, the veteran in Hibby made essentially a two-part argument in the Court of Appeals and in this court. His argument was, number one, that the Attorney General deliberately violated the 1940 Act, and that, number two, present-day citizenship was therefore appropriate as an equitable remedy. Now, the Ninth Circuit in Hibby adopted this two-part analysis, and we would submit that if the case caption of the name and the references to the parties were removed, the Ninth Circuit's opinion in Hibby is virtually a carbon copy of its current opinion. There's really no analytical distinction. The court first said that the Attorney General violated the will of Congress, and secondly, that citizenship was appropriate as an equitable remedy. Now, this court summarily reversed and held that the conduct of the Attorney General at issue was not affirmative misconduct and therefore could not have stopped the enforcement of the statutory cutoff date. And in the conclusion of its opinion, the court stated in no uncertain terms that respondents' effort to claim citizenship under a statute which by its terms had expired more than 20 years before he filed his lawsuit must therefore fail. And now we have somebody coming in with the same identical arguments, the same two-part analysis, and arguing for citizenship. And we think that Hibby is controlling, and we agree with the dissenting judges below, that there is simply no meaningful difference between saying that the government is equitably stopped from raising a statutory cutoff and disregarding the cutoff as a matter of equity. Furthermore, we would submit Hibby is not only dispositive of the statutory arguments, but is dispositive of the constitutional arguments. Now, let me say at the outset that it's important to emphasize that the Court of Appeals did not reach the constitutional issues. So it simply makes no sense to distinguish Hibby on the ground that these parties are raising constitutional issues. That would only be a distinction as a way of defending the Court of Appeals case if the Court of Appeals had, in fact, decided the case on constitutional grounds. But in any event, as we point out, the constitutional argument is in essence the same argument that was made before. It's simply new labels being attached to old argument. And the policies in Hibby about why a court should not, in that occasion, 20 years later, now 40 years later, ignore the public policy of a cutoff apply equally well whether you label the claim equitable estoppel, equitable relief, or due process. And in fact, numerous of this court's decisions dealing with equitable estoppel would confirm that. For example, in Immigration Naturalization Service versus Miranda, where the court held that the government was not equitably estopped because of its delay in processing an application for adjustment of status, it would be rather odd if the alien in that case could come back in and say that delay violated his constitutional rights and he's therefore entitled to adjustment of status based on the same allegation. The same thing would be true in Schweiker versus Hansen. The erroneous advice leading an individual not to get benefits for a period of time, the court held there was no equitable estoppel there. It would be rather odd if the person could come right back in, put the label due process on and suddenly be eligible for all these benefits. If I could, if there are no questions on the Hibby point, turn to the equitable issues. And it's important to emphasize in all of these statutes that I'm discussing that the reason we're discussing them is because this court in numerous of its foreign affairs decisions has looked to the congressional response, congressional acquiescence, in determining whether or not the Attorney General did something that violated the will of Congress. And as we have pointed out, you have an array of statutes, most compellingly the 48 statute, which states in no uncertain terms that even individuals who had applied under the 1940 Act and who had their applications pending, that those applications were to be decided under the 1948 Act. Now, if Congress was willing to see individuals who had made timely applications have their rights or benefits, rather, dealt with under the 48 statute, it could not have intended that individuals such as those here would be eligible for citizenship 40 years later. It's important to emphasize.
Mr. Klonoff, then it's your submission that the 1948 Act cut off the claims of some people who had made application under the earlier Act and would have qualified under the earlier Act.
That's exactly our submission. That's clear from the face of the 1948 Act, that individuals who had applied under Section 701 before the December 31st cutoff, those applications were to be treated not under the 40 Act, but under the 48 Act. And our submission is that it's an a fortiori. If individuals who had met the cutoff had their benefits cut off under the 40 Act, it could not be that individuals such as respondent, who, number one, didn't apply during the period, and number two, didn't even know about overseas naturalization, Congress could not have intended that those individuals be eligible 40 years later. It's important to emphasize we're dealing with what has now come to be called Category 2. These phrases were coined by a district judge in the 68 Filipinos case. Category 2 are individuals who made no efforts whatsoever prior to the cutoff to obtain citizenship. And in fact, it is clear from the record in this case that not a single one of the 16 respondents even knew about the program. And in fact, one of our submissions here in this court is that it is difficult to understand how the respondents can claim they were injured when they didn't even know about the program. Had there been an examiner there, we do not understand how they can claim injury when they did not learn of the when they did not even know about the program. The subsequent statutes are as clear as the 1948 Act. The 52 Act specifically lists the territories that are included within the concept of United States and its territories, and it excludes the Philippine Islands. So once again, and again, just like the 48 statute, that applies to applications that were pending under the 1948 Act. Congress explicitly stated in the 52 statute that applications under the 40 Act that were pending but had not been ruled upon were to be decided under the 52 statute. And again, you have the same a fortiori. If the pending applications were to be treated under the 52 Act, it could not be the case that Congress anticipated that applications that had not even been filed until decades later should be treated under the 40 Act rather than the 52 Act. And then, perhaps the most compelling statute of all in some sense, because it is, in essence, an overall umbrella of these other statutes, is the 1961 statute, where Congress said that all applications for naturalization have to be considered under the 1952 Act. That was Section 310E of the 52 Act in 1961. So the Court of Appeals, in order to order equitable relief in this case, not only had to ignore the 1940 Act, the 46 cutoff, but it had to ignore all of these other statutes as well. And we share the concern of the dissenting judges below that there's something wrong if a court, just by putting on a hat that says equity, can order a remedy that violates a whole series of statutes that could not be more explicit. Let me turn to the issue now of whether, in fact, the Attorney General violated the 1940 Act. The Ninth Circuit had little problem concluding that there was such a violation, But as the dissenting judges noted, and as the court in Alighiero noted, the statute gave the Attorney General considerable discretion in deciding where to place the examiners. There is nothing in the statute that said examiners had to be placed at specific locations for specific periods of time. You then have the added layer of the foreign policy decision that was involved here. And the contemporaneous historical documents are quite clear as to what happened. The Attorney General initially made a decision, even though the statute did not require it, after consultation with his subordinates, that he would apply the statute in the Philippines under a generous and reasonable interpretation of the statute. It was only when the foreign policy issue arose that the decision was made to revoke the examiner. There's a document which is quoted in a number of the court decisions in this area from September 1945 to Attorney General Tom Clark, indicating that the Philippine government had expressed its concern that if the naturalization program were carried out, as many as 250,000 people, the best young men for the Philippines would suddenly leave that newly emerging country for the United States, and you'd have a country that would not have a nucleus of its own, an army of its own. And it was only upon obtaining this memorandum that the Attorney General initialed the memorandum and made the decision that he would revoke the naturalization authority. After Congress made clear that being in the Commonwealth Army did not qualify an individual for the benefits of being in the United States Armed Forces, the Attorney General again reinstituted the authority of the naturalization examiner in the Philippines, because at that point, since it was then being applied to members of the Scouts rather than the Commonwealth, which was a much smaller number, the concerns that had initially been raised by the Philippine government were no longer a problem. So we would urge the court then to follow the reasoning of the decision in Alighiero and to hold that the Attorney General's conduct was permissible under the 40 Act. And if I could just briefly touch upon the court's Miranda decision, since that was relied upon quite heavily by the Court of Appeals. We strongly agree with the dissenting judges below that the court could not have intended, in a decision that did not raise any question involving Philippine veterans, to in effect decide that citizenship was now going to be available for thousands of Philippine veterans. It was simply not an issue in the case. And we would urge the court, therefore, we have offered an explanation of the language in Miranda. The court in Miranda, in saying that the Attorney General, that the action was error, was referring not only to Hibby, but also to the court's Montana decision. And a reading of the Montana decision leaves grave doubt as to whether or not there was any error. That was a situation, the court may recall, where a consular official indicated to a woman that she should not travel in her condition. She was pregnant at the time. And there was a question of whether or not that was inappropriate advice. But it's anything but clear, as the court itself indicated in Miranda, whether this was error or was simply well-intended advice that she shouldn't travel in that condition. So Montana itself confirms that the court did not mean to necessarily declare that there was error. And we would submit that the point being made in Miranda was simply to emphasize that in Miranda you simply had delay or negligence, whereas there were deliberate acts involved in Hibby. But we don't think that this court intended, in a context where the issue was not even before, to resolve these difficult questions. Finally, I would note briefly one of our submissions that has, in this kind of a situation where you're awarding equitable relief, the Court of Appeals seemed to believe that once it had decided there was a wrong, it had to find a remedy. And we submit that that's simply an erroneous understanding of the role of an equitable court, that a court, in effect, has to balance the equities. And one thing that could not be stronger against the position of the respondents is that they did not assert their claimed entitlement to citizenship until 40 years later, or 30 years later at the least. And as we've explained, individuals who knew about the program back in the 1940s are guilty of laches for waiting so long. And the individuals who did not even learn about the program until the 1970s or 80s can hardly claim that they were prejudiced or injured as a result of the decision. In fact, we've cited some law review articles that analyze this court's Hibby decision as at bottom a balancing of the equities. But the Court of Appeals apparently was of the view that once it decided there was a wrong, it didn't have to balance the equities. So we would urge the court, if it reaches that issue, and we submit there's no reason to get to the issue of remedies, but if the court reaches that issue, we urge the court to hold that at this late date, given the potential disruption of the immigration system, the delay in asserting the claim of citizenship and so forth, that there is no basis for equitable relief. I would reserve the balance for rebuttal unless there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Klonoff. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Unger.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, there are three things I hope you will do when you decide these cases. The first of these is to tell the government that you really meant it when you said the Attorney General's error was clear when he made it impossible for qualified World War II veterans to be naturalized in the Philippines in 1945. The second is to take a closer look at just what the error was and to recognize that it was more than the ordinary neglect or oversight that the majority opinion described it as in the Hibby case. Rather, it was an intentional, deliberate decision by the Attorney General of the United States to keep the offer of citizenship away from qualified veterans. It was a decision, in other words, to prevent the enforcement of the law as Congress had written it.
Asking us to overrule a part of Hibby?
I'm asking you to take another look at the facts in Hibby. I think in Hibby, the majority opinion looked at the facts in a more traditional equitable estoppel context. In a typical equitable estoppel argument against the government, an applicant is suggesting that he was misled to his detriment by some erroneous advice that a government official may have given him. Mr. Hibby couldn't make that kind of argument because there was no misleading of him. No immigration officer or federal official went out to him and said to him erroneously that you're not eligible for naturalization. And so the court, or the majority in that case, seemed to conclude that because there was no affirmative act which misled Mr. Hibby, that there was no estoppel. It could give rise to no estoppel.
Well, it not only seemed to conclude, it did conclude.
Well, that's not the way the majority characterized what happened. The majority characterized what happened as a mere failure to publicize the availability of this wartime naturalization law and a mere failure to station an examiner in the Philippines during all of the time that veterans like Mr. Hibby were eligible to apply. But it wasn't just a mere failure. And if the majority was saying a mere failure does not give rise to an estoppel, it certainly did not consider the issue of whether a deliberate decision to disregard the law would give rise to estoppel. In that sense, I think you can look back at Hibby and come to a different conclusion.
Our opinion in Hibby concludes, as the Solicitor General has reminded us, saying that the respondent's claim must fail. And yet the Ninth Circuit has gone back and said, no, it need not fail.
Well, in Hibby, the majority said it must fail because there was nothing more than neglect. It was obvious from the opinion that the majority considered it nothing but a matter of neglect because the Hibby's decision was based upon the old Utah Power and Light case.
Well, do you think it's open to a lower court to re-canvass facts that have been characterized by this court in a particular way?
Well, I don't think the court in this court characterized that in the way that the court below saw it. The court below saw it as a deliberate violation of a statutory obligation by the Attorney General.
Well, were there new facts presented to the Ninth Circuit that had not been presented earlier?
No, the facts are identical. Mr. Hibby's facts and the facts presented by these respondents is identical. But the analysis that was applied by this court was not the analysis provided by the court below, and it was not inconsistent with.
Yeah, but ordinarily, when the Ninth Circuit analyzes a case one way and we analyze it another, we prevail. But apparently that isn't the case here.
Well, I think it is important how the perception of what happened determines how one analyzes the case. And the majority in Hibby perceived the case as nothing but mere neglect, whereas the true facts were much more than mere neglect. In any event, I hope you won't consider Hibby to be dispositive because the veterans in this case have raised a different legal issue. That is, they have raised due process issues that Mr. Hibby did not raise and were not considered in his particular case.
Is the Solicitor General correct or incorrect in saying that the Ninth Circuit did not pass on these constitutional issues?
No, he's correct. The Ninth Circuit did not pass on it, and as we've indicated in our briefs, we believe that this Court may pass on those issues if it so chooses, or remand it if it's for consideration of those issues if it comes to that conclusion. Let me turn first to the question of error. The Solicitor General suggests that the Attorney General did have the authority to halt the naturalization program in the Philippines in 1945. I think the place to start, first of all, is with the fact that what Congress had done here was to enact a statute in the exercise of its exclusive naturalization authority. Congress, and only Congress, can determine who is to be naturalized. That's not the function of the Attorney General of the United States. And in this particular place, if we look at the language and the purpose of the statute and the means that Congress chose to implement that statute, it seems to me that it's quite clear that the Attorney General did have the obligation to carry out that law by naturalizing any qualified veteran. The language of the statute is clear. It says that any qualified veteran may be naturalized. The purpose of the statute was to provide naturalization for qualified veterans in exchange for the service that they provided to the United States Armed Forces during the war. And the means to make sure that soldiers and sailors overseas would have the opportunity to apply, the statute, Section 705, specifically called upon the Attorney General and the Commissioner of Immigration to take whatever action is appropriate, to make appropriate rules and regulation for the purpose of carrying the law into effect, not to frustrate the purpose of the law. That was the mandate that Congress provided in the 1942 amendments to the 1940 Act. And I think it's clear from what happened that during the war itself, from 1942 onward throughout the war, the Attorney General recognized that that was his obligation. Commissioner of Immigration sent representatives all over the world during the war to naturalize qualified veterans.
Or that he was authorized to do it.
I beg your pardon?
All that necessarily acknowledged was that he had the authority to do it, not that he was obliged to do it.
Well, I think it's more than
necessarily prove that he was obliged to do it.
Well, he looked upon it that way. I think there was certainly the language of the statute said he is authorized to do this, but in the context of the statute, the purpose being to naturalize veterans overseas, Congress certainly made that intention clear. And since they set up this mechanism for doing it, it seems to me it was apparent that he had to follow and implement the statute by following that mechanism.
Other things being equal, I mean, there are a lot of reasons why if he didn't have enough money to send them to all countries, he'd have to select some countries. And what he's saying here is that there was another factor that came into account, some foreign affairs factor.
Right.
But
well,
the statute was not mandatory. It didn't say he shall station these examiners.
Well, I think there's a difference between saying that he didn't have to send an examiner to a particular country because he didn't have the funds or he didn't have the manpower or because of the exigencies of war he couldn't send people to certain parts of the world. I think there's a big difference between that and a situation where he says, I have the manpower. There was a vice consul on the scene. The law says that these people are entitled to be naturalized, but I'm going to take it away from them,
Mr. Unger,
to prevent the offer from being accepted.
I dropped a stitch somewhere. Did your veteran serve in the armed forces of the United States?
Yes.
Well, the Solicitor General constantly refers to the Commonwealth Army of the Philippines.
Right.
What's the difference?
Well, there were two segments of the armed forces insofar as it applied to Filipinos who were residing in the Philippines. One was a unit called the Philippine Scouts, which was a direct part of the United States Army from the very beginning.
Were your veterans in the Philippine Scouts?
Some were and some weren't. Some were also in the Philippines Commonwealth Army, which was an army raised by the Commonwealth of the Philippines prior to its independence. And what happened was that under the Philippines Independence Act of 1934, the President of the United States was given the authority in time of emergency to take the armed forces of the Philippines Commonwealth and make it a part of the United States Armed Forces, which he did. President Roosevelt in 1941 issued an executive order taking the Philippines Commonwealth Army and bringing it into the armed forces of the United States. They all served under the same flag. They all wore the same uniform once the war started, and they were all considered part of the armed forces of the United States. And it was, as I think it's been suggested here, in 1946, the purpose of the 1946 Act was to save money. Congress realized at that point, perhaps, that it would cost them a lot of money to provide GI Bill and other benefits for the Commonwealth soldiers, among others. And so it wrote into the law that legislation which barred them from being considered for certain monetary benefits that other soldiers and sailors were entitled to.
Argued in Hibby, was it not, although it doesn't appear in our opinion, the argument was made that it was unlawful for the Attorney General not to station these officers in the Philippines.
The argument was made that it was unlawful for him to withdraw the officer for the avowed purpose of preventing people who were entitled to be naturalized, the avowed purpose of preventing them from being
naturalized. And that was the basis of the Ninth Circuit's holding that time around.
That was the Ninth Circuit. In addition, the
It's not a new legal point you're bringing up. You just want to recharacterize it as not estoppel now, but what? We can remedy it by our equitable powers.
Well,
is there any new legal issue that's before us in this case?
I'm sorry, I missed the line.
Is there any new legal issue that's before us in this case other than the difference between estoppel and equitable discretion?
I think there is a difference between estoppel and equitable discretion, perhaps, on the one hand, and the due process arguments on the other.
The due process arguments.
Right. I think there is a difference there. And I think that's an important difference because if you were considering the due process violation, this issue of affirmative misconduct is irrelevant. One doesn't have to find affirmative misconduct on the part of federal officials in order to find a constitutional violation. The error is enough. I think it's important in that respect. And also, the due process argument is also important because of subsequent post-war legislation, because when the Congress cannot legislate away, so to speak, a constitutional injury to these people. So that would also be important for that reason. Getting back to the issue of error, whether the Attorney General had the authority to withdraw the examiner from the Philippines during that time, the government says, first of all, that that perhaps the Filipinos who were serving there were not entitled to naturalization in the first place. I think what Mr. Klonoff is forgetting is that the Attorney General made that determination in 1945 that Filipinos, like these respondents, were eligible for naturalization. That's not really an issue before the court anymore. They were determined to be within the scope of this particular statute. As to the Foreign Affairs Authority, it's true. I mean, it's true that the Executive Department has great authority in the field of foreign affairs. But here we have a statute under which Congress, exercising its naturalization power, said these people shall be naturalized. There is no case which says that the executive branch can take action in the field of foreign affairs despite an act of Congress which provides an opposite intent. I don't think the foreign affairs powers really goes that far. As to the fact that Congress did not discuss specifically the issue of what it would want to do in the event of objections by the Philippines government, that's part of the foreign affairs issue, so to speak. It seems to me that it's hard to believe that Congress would have wanted to take away the offer of citizenship from Filipinos in the Philippines for such reasons, because when Congress enacted this law, it made it specifically applicable to persons who were residing in the United States or its territories or possessions. And, of course, at that time, the Philippines was the largest of the United States possessions. They used language in the law that a person who served in the armed forces and who was not a citizen, rather than using the term alien, is significant that Congress meant to include Filipinos, because Filipinos were then by far the largest number of people who were neither citizens nor aliens, but non-citizen nationals. So the use of that language certainly indicates an intent to include Filipinos who are residing in the Philippines within the scope of this statute. And as Justice Stevens has pointed out, this law was enacted at the very moment that the battles of Bataan and Corregidor were making headlines all across the country. Congress must have known that the Philippines was going to become independent at some future date. It must have known that President Roosevelt had brought all of these people into the army to suggest that Congress did not want these particular people to be naturalized. It seems to be inconsistent with all of those particular ideas, and that if Congress really had wanted to exclude those Filipinos under these circumstances, it would have made that intention explicit. It certainly didn't do that. I think I've touched on the idea already about whether the Attorney General had an implied delegation of authority to withhold the benefits of the naturalization law from people in the Philippines. Section 705, as I've indicated, did delegate a certain amount of authority to the Attorney General and the Commissioner of Immigration to place representatives in various parts of the world. As I pointed out before, there's a big difference between the authority to do that, the obvious discretion that he would have in light of scheduling and manpower problems and what was going on in the war. There's a big difference between that and deliberately removing an examiner who was already there for the purpose, the express purpose, of taking away the offer of citizenship that Congress had made to them. It seems to me if the Attorney General felt that there were reasons not to grant citizenship to Filipinos in the Philippines in 1945, it was for Congress to make that decision, because only Congress can determine who is to be naturalized, and that when the Attorney General made that decision, he really crossed the constitutional line between his role as a person who is supposed to faithfully execute the law with Congress's role to make the laws, particularly in the area of naturalization.
Mr. Unger, would you comment on your opponent's argument that they could not have been prejudiced if none of them even knew about the program?
Well, the government suggests that none of these people were injured because we don't know whether they ever would have found out about their opportunity to apply had the examiner remained on duty in the Philippines during that particular period of time. Well, of course, none of us will ever know that, but it seems to me that that sort of argument is putting these respondents in an impossible position. It's the government that's responsible for that. The government is saying, how can you tell us that you would have heard about this law when we, the government, have taken away the only way, the means that you could have applied, the only way that you could have learned, presumably, would be if we had left an examiner there. It's possible that word of mouth would have reached these people.
Well, didn't the government have a duty to tell them?
I think so. I mean, I think there was an obligation
like
to do that.
The guy that was charged with murdering his parents and pleaded an offer.
Right.
That's the argument that the government is making. We didn't tell you about it.
I think
so you didn't apply, so now you're out.
I think it's significant there, too, because other soldiers elsewhere were notified of the opportunity to apply. There was a War Department circular that called upon.
Heavy, isn't it?
It is a hard argument under that. I agree with you in that respect. I think, in all fairness, it's difficult, too, because for another reason, and that is that these people, these men who were in the Philippine Scouts and the Philippine Army, they were captured after the fall of Bataan and Corregidor and spent time in prison camps, were stranded in the Philippine Islands during the war. It would have been difficult to get notice to them. And when they came back, I beg your pardon?
They want to march clean across the island.
That's correct.
No food, no anything.
So I think that underscores the injustice of what was done here. Here were people that put their lives on the line for the United States at a very critical time in the war. They were promised American citizenship in exchange for that service. And when the war ended, for reasons which the Attorney General seemed to think were okay, we simply said, well, it's too bad, the war is over, we'll forget about your opportunity to apply for naturalization.
But, Mr. Unger, Congress itself changed its mind in 1948, didn't it?
That's true.
It's not as if this had always been on the books. This was a statute that was, in effect, a very short time, and then Congress, which is the source of authority, changed its mind.
Well, first of all, that was another Congress. And secondly, this was 1948, and I think there's no evidence in this record to show that Congress knew that the Attorney General had violated his duty under the 1942 Act. I think the 1948 Act, the enactment of that bill, one can presuppose that Congress assumed that everybody who was covered under the 1942 Act would have had a fair chance to apply.
Well, but here the war is... If the Solicitor General is correct, I would think maybe that isn't right, because I understood him to say that those whose applications were pending and qualified under the Act, some of them were cut off under the 1948 Act.
That's true, and it's interesting also, Your Honor, that Mr. Klinoff refers to the Category 2 veterans and Category 1 veterans. Category 1 veterans are those who learned about the opportunity to apply during the war and made an effort to apply but were told that they were ineligible to do so. Now, the government is acquiescing in their naturalization even today, on the theory that they made an effort to do it and there was some sort of, as an equitable matter, they should be naturalized today. If one followed Mr. Klonoff's argument to its logical conclusion, they shouldn't be naturalized either because the 1948 Act would have cut them off. But I think the main point is that 1948 was 2 years after Philippine independence. Congress could have looked at the situation and said, look, we gave you people an opportunity to apply for naturalization during the war and right after the war. You had a fair chance to do that, and if you chose not to accept American citizenship, well, we're just not going to extend it anymore. There's no indication here that Congress knew that these people were deprived of their opportunity to apply in 1945 and 1946. Had they known that, maybe there would have been a different result. But I don't think it's fair to suggest that because there was an enactment in 1948 that Congress really meant to cut off the rights of someone who was injured by governmental conduct prior to that time.
Of course, the whole thing might have been a mistake from the beginning. We don't really know for sure that when Congress said the military and naval forces of the United States, it meant to include the Commonwealth Army.
Well, one could have made that interpretation, I suppose, and if they had made that interpretation, I guess we wouldn't be here today. But the fact is that that was the interpretation that the Attorney General made in 1945.
But it makes the injustice, if that's what it was, seem a little less acute when it was a dicey question whether that language would have been interpreted to include Filipinos in any event.
Well, that question is never really...
One group of people on the basis of race and deny them something, I don't know what else you can call.
Well, I think that's also true. That's a separate issue, that only Filipinos as a class were discriminated against in the operation of this particular law.
Well, it wouldn't be on the basis. It would be on the basis of what army they served in, whether they served in the Army of the United States or an army that was not an army.
No, I don't think that's true at all. They were barred from becoming citizens because they were Filipinos, and we didn't want them coming to the United States for whatever reason at that time.
Well, these people all served under General MacArthur, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
Just to get back to Justice Stevens' question about the injury, I think it's really asking the respondents to prove the impossible to say that they would have heard about this law had the examiner remained on duty in the Philippines in 1945. And I hope the outcome of this case is not going to turn on that particular question. We'll never know what could have happened if the examiner had stayed there. But it seems to me that's the reason we don't know is the government's own error, and that shouldn't prejudice these respondents in that particular light. And I think it's also important to remember in that context that these veterans were cut off during the war from all opportunity to learn about the law. All this happened as the war was drawing to a close, and they were scattered throughout the Philippines. There was only one examiner in Manila who was doing this, and there was no official notice to these people as there was to others. And the fact is that some people did find out about it. The Category 1 people that we've referred to did find out about their opportunity, and they must have found out about it through word of mouth. So it seems to me logical to assume that had the officer remained there, there certainly was a better chance that these people would have found out about their opportunity to be naturalized and would have taken whatever steps were appropriate to apply.
Yes. Is there any evidence as to whether there was any publicity in newspapers, even the Army papers, you know, I can't remember the name of it now, but this program wasn't discussed?
There's no evidence at all that I could find to show that these people in the Philippines were notified about their opportunity to apply for naturalization. Mr. Klonoff refers to the Fedorenko and the Ginsburg cases as suggesting that a court is not allowed to look beyond what the statute provides with respect to naturalization. It seems to me there's a difference between those cases in determining what there's a difference, in other words, in determining whether an individual is eligible for naturalization, in which case, obviously, a court has to look at the naturalization statute as Congress provided. What happened here was different. It wasn't a question of whether these Filipino veterans were eligible for naturalization. Rather, it was a decision to bar them from even applying. I think there's a big difference, which allows the court to provide a remedy, whether on a constitutional or an equitable basis.
May I ask one other question that goes to the remedy matter? Do we know how many people have an interest in the outcome of this case?
No, we really don't know. I think the government has been arguing large numbers from the very beginning in the Hibby case when they filed their petition for certiorari in the Hibby case, who was a scout, by the way, in the much smaller unit. And at that time, the government was suggesting that as many as 30,000 Filipino scouts were still alive and would apply, and 80,000 dependents would apply. And that's only the scouts. Now, here it is 20 years later. Since the reason that many of these people found out about the law in later years was the Hibby litigation and the 68 veteran litigation. All this has been going on for 20 years, and at most, we have a couple of thousand people who've come forward now to make applications. So it seems to me the numbers involved are very small. I don't know what the exact numbers are. There are certain petitions pending in various courts around the country. But clearly they're small in terms of overall immigration, where we invite as many as 800,000 people a year into the country legally. It's small in terms of the 2 million or so people we've invited to come in and apply for amnesty. Common sense tells us that it has to be a small number because these are an aging group of people. I mean, in this particular case, the youngest man is 64, the oldest is in his 80s. There aren't that many more who are going to be able to come here. I think one has to start out with
I assume that's irrelevant to our decision, of course.
Well,
I mean, if
I think it's relevant
provide
perhaps
justice
in this
to a lot of
balance.
People or just a few people.
I beg your pardon?
I'm not sure it is. When you weigh the equities in a case like this, I think one might consider the public consequences.
Well, that's
sure
the point I was going to make. I think
on the remedy issue.
It may be relevant in a balancing of equity situation. What I'm trying to suggest is the weight to that particular argument ought to be very small because there can't be very many. We're going to benefit. Children are not going to benefit. These are men in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. Mm-hmm. The only kinds of children who would benefit under our immigration laws would be unmarried minor children mm-hmm. who would come here to the United States outside of the quota system. Mm-hmm. Present quota system from the Philippines is so oversubscribed that any adult child of an American citizen has to wait 10 years or more.
Well, I suppose,
to come
but
here.
If they had a chance to qualify and be naturalized way back when, their children would have...
They would have been born in this country, and they'd be natural-born citizens.
Yes, well, how come equity wouldn't reach them?
The persons who were born in the United States? I'm sorry, I follow your...
Persons, children of these aging men, who, if they had been naturalized way back when, would have been citizens of the United States.
That's probably true.
Well, why won't equity protect them, disputed?
Well, it's another step forward, and I think it would be a much harder argument.
Well, that would
argument.
Be the next case.
You mean they can only come to this country without their children?
Well, they could
you
only
tell
come
them
to this
you can leave the Philippines, and so long as you leave
at
your family.
At that time, if they were still young enough and these people were naturalized, they could have come. But the fact is, if you're weighing the equities and balancing the equities, you have to do it as of today. And as of today, there aren't going to be very many children of these veterans, if any, who are going to come
well,
to the United States.
Well, as of today, the law has expired.
I think the law may have expired, but for the reasons I've indicated, that court has the authority to remedy the wrong that was done to these people, either on constitutional or equitable principles. I think the bottom line in this case, as I've always felt, is that Congress made a promise to these people back in 1942 that they could become American citizens if they served in the armed forces. These people did serve in the armed forces of the United States. They were entitled under the law to be naturalized. The Attorney General did not give them the authority to do that, did not allow them to do that. He violated his authority under that law, which was contrary to the intent of Congress. And since he had no authority to do that, I think the Court has the authority to provide a remedy despite the many considerations that Mr. Klonoff has referred to in terms of subsequent legislation and so on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Unger. Mr. Klonoff, you have 1 minute remaining.
Very briefly, on the Hibby point, I would just refer the Court to page 3 of our reply brief, in which it is quite clear that the arguments made in Hibby by the respondent in the memorandum in opposition, which was the pleading before the Court since it was summarily reversed, are identical to the arguments made here, the characterization of the case.
Mr. Klonoff, on the equitable discretion point, how did these Class 1 veterans who had applied but not yet been naturalized, how do they get in if there's no equitable power to ignore the subsequent repealer of the law?
That's a very good question. The decision on Category 1 was made as a policy matter, and quite frankly, that's a policy decision that, depending on how the Court analyzes the issue, is going to have to be reconsidered in the future.
You mean the executive has that equitable power, but the courts
don't? Well, the executive doesn't rule on naturalization. The executive makes a recommendation, and all that was happening is that the executive wasn't affirmatively opposing naturalization. It's a decision that's made by the courts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klonoff. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Monday next at 10 o'clock.